Nothing is too doubtful to be of use to them as they seek to redeem their bodies from a lifetime of bad posture. It is the end of skepticism. We walked home under a marigold moon. Our house looked old and wan at the end of the street, the porch light shining on a molded plastic tricycle, a stack of 3-hour colored flame sawdust and wax logs. Denise was doing her homework in the kitchen, keeping an eye on Wilder, who had wandered downstairs to sit on the floor and stare through the oven window. Silence in the halls, shadows on the sloping lawn. We closed the door and disrobed. The bed was a mess. Magazines, curtain rods, a child's sooty sock. Babette hummed something from a Broadway show, putting the rods in a corner. We embraced, fell sideways to the bed in a controlled way, then repositioned ourselves, bathing in each other's flesh, trying to kick the sheets off our ankles. Her body had a number of long hollows, places the hands might stop to solve in the dark, tempo-slowing places. We believed something lived in the basement.
"What do you want to do?" she said.
"Whatever you want to do."
"I want to do whatever's best for you."
"What's best for me is to please you," I said.
"I want to make you happy, Jack."
"I'm happy when I'm pleasing you."
"I just want to do what you want to do."
"I want to do whatever's best for you."
"But you please me by letting me please you," she said.
"As the male partner, I think it's my responsibility to please."
"I'm not sure whether that's a sensitive, caring statement or a sexist remark."
"Is it wrong for the man to be considerate toward his partner?"
"I'm your partner when we play tennis, which we ought to start doing again, by the way. Otherwise, I'm your wife. Do you want me to read to you?"
"First rate."
"I know you like me to read sexy stuff."
"I thought you liked it, too."
"Isn't it basically the person being read to who derives the benefit and the satisfaction? When I read to Old Man Treadwell, it's not because I find those tabloids stimulating."
"Treadwell's blind. I'm not."
"I thought you liked to read erotic passages."
"If it pleases you, then I like to do it."
"But it has to please you too, Baba, otherwise how would I feel?" "It pleases me that you enjoy my reading."
"I get the feeling of burden is being shifted back and forth, the burden of being the one who is pleased."
"I want to read, Jack, honestly."
"Are you totally and completely sure? Because if you're not, we absolutely won't."
Someone turned on the TV set at the end of the hall, and a woman's voice said, "If it breaks easily into pieces, it is called shale. When wet, it smells like clay."
We listened to the gently plummeting stream of nighttime traffic. I said, "Pick your century. Do you want to read about Etruscan slave girls? Georgian rakes? I think we have some literature on flagellation brothels. What about the Middle Ages? We have incubi and succubi, nuns galore."
"Whatever's best for you."
"I want you to choose. It's sexier that way."
"One person chooses, the other reads. Don't we want a balance, a sort of give and take? Isn't that what makes it sexy?"
"A tautness, a suspense, first rate. I will choose."
"I will read," she said.
"But I don't want you to choose anything that has men inside women, quote, quote, or men entering women. I entered her. He entered me. We're not lobbies or elevators. I want him inside me, as if he could crawl completely in, sign the register, sleep, eat, so forth.
Can we agree on that?" I don't care what these people do as long as they don't enter or get entered.
Agreed.
I entered her and began to thrust.
I'm in total agreement, I said.
Enter me, yes, yes.
Silly usage, absolutely.
Insert yourself, Rex. I want you inside me, entering hard, entering deep. Yes, now, oh!
I began to feel an erection stirring. How stupid and out of context. Babette laughed at her own lines. The TV said, "Until Florida surgeons attached an artificial flipper." Babette and I tell each other everything. I have told everything, such as it was at the time, to each of my wives. There is more to tell, of course, as marriages accumulate. But when I say I believe in complete disclosure, I don't mean it cheaply, as anecdotal sport or shallow revelation. It is a form of self-renewal and a gesture of custodial trust. Love helps us develop an identity secure enough to allow itself to be placed in another's care and protection. Babette and I have turned our lives for each other's thoughtful regard, turned them in the moonlight in our pale hands, spoken deep into the night about fathers and mothers, childhood, friendships, awakenings, old loves, old fears, except fear of death. No detail must be left out, not even a dog with ticks or a neighbor's boy who ate an insect on a dare. The smell of pantries, the sense of empty afternoons, the feel of things as they rained across our skin. Things as facts and passions. The feel of pain, loss, disappointment, breathless delight. In these night recitations, we create a space between things as we felt them at the time, and as we speak them now. This is the space reserved for irony, sympathy, and fond amusement, the means by which we rescue ourselves from the past. I decided on the 20th century. I put on my bathrobe and went down the hall to Heinrich's room to find a trashy magazine Babette might read from, the type that features letters from readers detailing their sexual experiences. This struck me as one of the few things the modern imagination has contributed to the history of erotic practices. There is a double fantasy at work in such letters. People write down imagined episodes and then see them published in a national magazine. Which is the greater stimulation? Wilder was in there watching Heinrich do a physics experiment with steel balls and a salad bowl. Heinrich wore a terry cloth robe, a towel around his neck, another towel on his head. He told me to look downstairs. In a stack of material I found some family photo albums, one or two of them at least 50 years old. I took them up to the bedroom. We spent hours going through them, sitting up in bed. Children wincing in the sun, women in sun hats, men shading their eyes from the glare as if the past possessed some quality of light we no longer experience. A Sunday dazzle that caused people in their church-going clothes to tighten their faces and stand at an angle to the future. Somewhat averted, it seemed. Wearing fixed and fine-drawn smiles, skeptical of something in the nature of the box camera. Who will die first? Chapter 8.
My struggle with the German tongue began in mid-October and lasted nearly the full academic year. As the most prominent figure in Hitler studies in North America, I had long tried to conceal the fact that I did not know German. I could not speak or read it, could not understand the spoken word or begin to put the simplest sentence on paper. The least of my Hitler colleagues knew some German. Others were either fluent in the language or reasonably conversant. No one could major in Hitler studies at the College on the Hill without a minimum of 1 year of German. I was living, in short, on the edge of a landscape of vast shame. The German tongue. Fleshy, warped, spit-spraying, purplish, and cruel. One eventually had to confront it. Wasn't Hitler's own struggle to express himself in German the crucial subtext of his massive ranting autobiography, dictated in a fortress prison in the Bavarian hills? Grammar and syntax. The man may have felt himself imprisoned in more ways than one. I've made several attempts to learn German, serious probes into origins, structures, roots. I sense the deathly power of the language. I wanted to speak it well, use it as a charm, a protective device. The more I shrank from learning actual words, rules, and pronunciation, the more important it seemed that I go forward. What we are reluctant to touch often seems the very fabric of our salvation. But the basic sounds defeated me, the harsh, spurting northernness of the words and syllables, the command delivery. Something happened between the back of my tongue and the roof of my mouth that made a mockery of my attempts to sound German words. I was determined to try again. Because I'd achieved high professional standing, because my lectures were well attended and my articles printed in the major journals, because I wore an academic gown and dark glasses day and night whenever I was on campus, because I carried 230 pounds on a 6-foot-3-inch frame and had big hands and feet, I knew my German lessons would have to be secret. I contacted a man not affiliated with the college, someone Murray J. Siskind had told me about. They were fellow boarders in the green shingled house on Middlebrook. The man was in his 50s, a slight shuffle in his walk. He had thinning hair, a bland face, and wore his shirt sleeves rolled up to his forearms, revealing thermal underwear beneath. His complexion was of a tone I want to call flesh-colored. Howard Dunlop was his name. He said he was a former chiropractor but didn't offer a reason why he was no longer active and didn't say when he'd learned German or why, and something in his manner kept me from asking. We sat in his dark, crowded room at the boarding house. An ironing board stood unfolded at the window. There were chipped enamel pots, trays of utensils set on a dresser. The furniture was vague, foundling. At the borders of the room were the elemental things, an exposed radiator, an army blanketed cot. Dunlop sat at the edge of a straight chair, intoning generalities of grammar. When he switched from English to German, it was as though a cord had been twisted in his larynx. An abrupt emotion entered his voice, a scrape and gargle that sounded like the starring of some beast's ambition. He gaped at me and gestured. He croaked. He verged on strangulation. Sounds came spewing from the base of his tongue, harsh noises damp with passion. He was only demonstrating certain basic pronunciation patterns, but the transformation in his face and voice made me think he was making a passage between levels of being. I sat there, taking notes. The hour went quickly. Dunlop managed a scant shrug when I asked him not to discuss the lessons with anyone. It occurred to me that he was the man Murray had described in his summary of fellow boarders as the one who never comes out of his room. I stopped at Murray's room and asked him to come home with me for dinner. He put down his copy of American Transvestite and slipped into his corduroy jacket. We stopped on the porch long enough for Murray to tell the landlord, who was sitting there, about a dripping faucet in the second-floor bathroom. The landlord was a large, florid man of such robust and bursting health that he seemed to be having a heart attack even as we looked on. "He'll get around to fixing it," Murray said, as we set out on foot in the direction of Elm. "He fixes everything eventually. He's very good with all those little tools and fixtures and devices that people in cities never know the names of. The names of these things are only known in outlying communities, small towns, and rural areas. Too bad he's such a bigot."
"How do you know he's a bigot?"
"People who can fix things are usually bigots."
"What do you mean?"
"Think of all the people who've ever come to your house to fix things. They were all bigots, weren't they?"
"I don't know."
"They drove panel trucks, didn't they? With an extension ladder on the roof and some kind of plastic charm dangling from the rearview mirror?"
"I don't know, Murray."
"It's obvious," he said. He asked me why I'd chosen this year in particular to learn German, after so many years of slipping past the radar. I told him there was a Hitler conference scheduled for next spring at the college on the hill. 3 days of lectures, workshops, and panels. Hitler scholars from 17 states and 9 foreign countries. Actual Germans would be in attendance. At home, Denise placed a moist bag of garbage in the kitchen compactor. She started up the machine. The ram stroked downward with a dreadful wrenching sound, full of eerie feeling. Children walked in and out of the kitchen. Water dripped in the sink. The washing machine heaved in the entranceway. Murray seemed engrossed in the incidental mesh. Whining metal, exploding bottles, plastic smashed flat. Denise listened carefully, making sure the mangling din contained the correct sonic elements, which meant the machine was operating properly. Heinrich said to someone on the phone, "Animals commit incest all the time, so how unnatural can it be?" Babette came in from running, her outfit soaked through. Murray walked across the kitchen to shake her hand. She fell into a chair, scanned the room for Wilder. I watched Denise make a mental comparison between her mother's running clothes and the wet bag she'd dumped in the compactor. I could see it in her eyes, a sardonic connection. It was these secondary levels of life, these extrasensory flashes and floating nuances of being, these pockets of rapport forming unexpectedly, that made me believe we were a magic act, adults and children together, sharing unaccountable things.
"We have to boil our water," Steffi said.
"Why?"
"It said on the radio."
"They're always saying, boil your water," Babette said. "It's the new thing, like turn your wheel in the direction of the skid.
Here comes Wilder now. I guess we can eat."
The small child moved in a swaying gait, great head wagging, and his mother made faces of delight, happy and outlandish masks, watching him approach.
"Neutrinos go right through the earth," Heinrich said into the telephone.
"Yes, yes, yes," said Babette.
Chapter 9. They had to evacuate the grade school on Tuesday. Kids were getting headaches and eye irritations, tasting metal in their mouths. A teacher rolled on the floor and spoke foreign languages. No one knew what was wrong. Investigators said it could be the ventilating system, the paint or varnish, the foam insulation, the electrical insulation, the cafeteria food, the rays emitted by microcomputers, the asbestos fireproofing, the adhesive on shipping containers, the fumes from the chlorinated pool, or perhaps something deeper, finer-grained, more closely woven into the basic state of things. Denise and Steffi stayed home that week, as men in Mylex suits and respirator masks made systematic sweeps of the building with infrared detecting and measuring equipment. Because Mylex is itself a suspect material, the results tended to be ambiguous, and a second round of more rigorous detection had to be scheduled. The two girls and Babette, Wilder and I, went to the supermarket.
Minutes after we entered, we ran into Murray. This was the fourth or fifth time I'd seen him in the supermarket, which was roughly the number of times I'd seen him on campus. He clutched Babette by the left bicep and sidled around her, appearing to smell her hair. "A lovely dinner," he said, standing directly behind her. "I like to cook myself, which doubles my appreciation of someone who does it well."
"Come any time," she said, turning in an effort to find him.
We moved together into the ultra-cool interior. Wilder sat in the shopping cart, trying to grab items off the shelves as we went by. It occurred to me that he was too old and too big to be sitting in supermarket carts. I also wondered why his vocabulary seemed to be stalled at 25 words. "I'm happy to be here," Murray said.
"In Blacksmith?"
"In Blacksmith? In the supermarket, in the rooming house, on the hill. I feel I'm learning important things every day. Death, disease, afterlife, outer space. It's all much clearer here. I can think and see."
We moved into the generic food area, and Murray paused with his plastic basket to probe among the white cartons and jars. I wasn't sure I understood what he was talking about. What did he mean, much clearer? He could think and see what?
Steffi took my hand and we walked past the fruit bins, an area that extended about 45 yards along one wall. The bins were arranged diagonally and backed by mirrors that people accidentally punched when reaching for fruit in the upper rows. A voice on the loudspeaker said, "Kleenex Softique, your truck's blocking the entrance." Apples and lemons tumbled in twos and threes to the floor when someone took a fruit from certain places in the stacked array. There were 6 kinds of apples. There were exotic melons in several pastels. Everything seemed to be in season, sprayed, burnished, bright. People tore filmy bags off racks and tried to figure out which end opened. I realized the place was awash in noise. The toneless systems, the jangle and skid of carts, the loudspeaker and coffee-making machines, the cries of children. And over it all, or under it all, a dull and unlocatable roar, as of some form of swarming life just outside the range of human apprehension.
"Did you tell Denise you were sorry?"
"Maybe later," Steffi said. "Remind me."
"She's a sweet girl, and she wants to be your older sister and your friend, if you'll let her."
"I don't know about friend. She's a little bossy, don't you think?"
"Aside from telling her you're sorry, be sure to give her back her physician's desk reference."
"She reads that thing all the time. Don't you think that's weird?"
"At least she reads something."
"Sure, lists of drugs and medicines. And do you want to know why?"
"Why?"
"Because she's trying to find out the side effects of the stuff that Baba uses."
"What does Baba use?"
"Don't ask me, ask Denise."
"How do you know she uses anything?"
"Ask Denise."
"Why don't I ask Baba?"
"Ask Baba," she said. Murray came out of an aisle and walked alongside Babette, just ahead of us. He took a twin roll of paper towels out of her cart and smelled it. Denise had found some friends, and they went up front to look at the paperback books in spindly racks. The books with shiny metallic print, raised letters, vivid illustrations of cult violence and windswept romance. Denise was wearing a green visor. I heard Babette tell Murray she'd been wearing it 14 hours a day for 3 weeks now. She would not go out without it, would not even leave her room. She wore it in school when there was school, wore it to the toilet, the dentist's chair, the dinner table. Something about the visor seemed to speak to her, to offer wholeness and identity. "It's her interface with the world," Murray said. He helped Babette push her loaded cart. I heard him say to her, "Tibetans believe there is a transitional state between death and rebirth. Death is a waiting period, basically. Soon a fresh womb will receive the soul. In the meantime, the soul restores to itself some of the divinity lost at birth." He studied her profile as if to detect a reaction. "That's what I think of whenever I come in here. This place recharges us spiritually. It prepares us. It's a gateway or pathway. Look how bright. It's full of psychic data." My wife smiled at him. "Everything is concealed in symbolism, hidden by veils of mystery and layers of cultural material. But it is psychic data, absolutely. The large doors slide open. They close unbidden. Energy waves, incident radiation. All the letters and numbers are here, all the colors of the spectrum, all the voices and sounds, all the code words and ceremonial phrases. It is just a question of deciphering, rearranging, peeling off the layers of unspeakability."
"Not that we would want to. Not that any useful purpose would be served. This is not Tibet. Even Tibet is not Tibet anymore."
He studied her profile. She put some yogurt in her cart. "Tibetans try to see death for what it is. It is the end of attachment to things. This simple truth is hard to fathom. But once we stop denying death, we can proceed calmly to die and then go on to experience uterine rebirth, or Judeo-Christian afterlife, or out-of-body experience, or a trip on a UFO, or whatever we wish to call it. We can do so with clear vision, without awe or terror. We don't have to cling to life artificially, or to death for that matter. We simply walk toward the sliding doors. Waves and radiation. Look how well lighted everything is. The place is sealed off, self-contained. It is timeless.
Another reason why I think of Tibet. Dying is an art in Tibet. A priest walks in, sits down, tells the weeping relatives to get out and has the room sealed. Doors, windows sealed. He has serious business to see to. Chants, numerology, horoscopes, recitations. Here we don't die, we shop. But the difference is less marked than you think."
He was almost whispering now, and I tried to get up closer without ramming my cart into Babette's. I wanted to hear everything.
"Supermarkets this large and clean and modern are a revelation to me. I spent my life in small, steamy delicatessens with slanted display cabinets full of trays that hold soft, wet, lumpy matter in pale colors. High enough cabinets so you had to stand on tiptoes to give your order. Shouts. Accents. In cities no one notices specific dying. Dying is a quality of the air. It's everywhere and nowhere. Men shout as they die, to be noticed, remembered for a second or two. To die in an apartment instead of a house can depress the soul, I would imagine, for several lives to come. In a town there are houses, plants in bay windows. People notice dying better. The dead have faces, automobiles. If you don't know a name, you know a street name, a dog's name. He drove an orange Mazda. You know a couple of useless things about a person that become major facts of identification and cosmic placement when he dies suddenly, after a short illness, in his own bed, with a comforter and matching pillows, on a rainy Wednesday afternoon, feverish, a little congested in the sinuses and chest, thinking about his dry cleaning."
Babette said, "Where is Wilder?" and turned to stare at me in a way that suggested 10 minutes had passed since she'd last seen him. Other looks, less pensive and less guilty, indicated greater time spans, deeper seas of inattention. Like, "I didn't know whales were mammals."
The greater the time span, the blanker the look, the more dangerous the situation. It was as if guilt were a luxury she allowed herself only when the danger was minimal. How could he get out of the cart without my noticing? The three adults each stood at the head of an aisle and peered into the traffic of carts and gliding bodies. Then we did three more aisles, heads set forward, weaving slightly as we changed our sight lines. I kept seeing colored spots off to the right, but when I turned there was nothing there. I'd been seeing colored spots for years, but never so many, so gaily animated. Murray saw Wilder in another woman's cart. The woman waved at Babette and headed toward us. She lived on our street with a teenage daughter and an Asian baby, Chun Duck. Everyone referred to the baby by name, almost in a tone of proud proprietorship, but no one knew who Chun belonged to or where he or she had come from.
Kleenex Softique! Kleenex Softique!
Steffi was holding my hand in a way I'd come to realize over a period of time was not meant to be gently possessive, as I'd thought at first, but reassuring. I was a little astonished. A firm grip that would help me restore confidence in myself, keep me from becoming resigned to whatever melancholy moods she thought she detected hovering about my person. Before Murray went to the express line, he invited us to dinner. A week from Saturday. You don't have to let me know until the last minute.
We'll be there, Babette said.
I'm not preparing anything major, so just call beforehand and tell me if something else came up. You don't even have to call. If you don't show up, I'll know that something came up and you couldn't let me know.
Murray will be there.
Bring the kids.
No.
Great. But if you decide to bring them, no problem. I don't want you to feel I'm holding you to something. Don't feel you've made an ironclad commitment. You'll show up or you won't. I have to eat anyway, so there's no major catastrophe if something comes up and you have to cancel. I just want you to know I'll be there if you decide to drop by, with or without kids. We have till next May or June to do this thing, so there's no special mystique about a week from Saturday.
Are you coming back next semester? I said.
They want me to teach a course in the cinema of car crashes.
Do it.
I will.
I rubbed against Babette in the checkout line. She backed into me, and I reached around her and put my hands on her breasts. She rotated her hips, and I nuzzled her hair and murmured, "Dirty blonde."
People wrote checks. Tall boys bagged the merchandise. Not everyone spoke English at the cash terminals, or near the fruit bins and frozen foods, or out among the cars in the lot. More and more, I heard languages I could not identify, much less understand, although the tall boys were American-born and the checkout women as well, short, fattish in blue tunics, wearing stretch slacks and tiny white espadrilles. I tried to fit my hands into Babette's skirt, over her belly, as the slowly moving line edged toward the last purchase point, the breath mints and nasal inhalers. It was out in the parking lot that we heard the first of the rumors about a man dying during the inspection of the grade school, one of the masked and Mylex-suited men, heavy-booted and bulky. Collapsed and died, went the story that was going around. In a classroom on the second floor. Chapter 10. Tuition at the college on the hill is $14,000, Sunday brunch included. I sense there is a connection between this powerful number and the way the students arrange themselves physically in the reading areas of the library. They sit on broad cushioned seats in various kinds of ungainly posture, clearly calculated to be the identifying signs of some kinship group or secret organization. They are fetal, splayed, knock-kneed, arched, square-knotted, sometimes almost upside down. The positions are so studied, they amount to a classical mime. There is an element of over-refinement and inbreeding. Sometimes I feel I've wandered into a Far Eastern dream, too remote to be interpreted. But it is only the language of economic class they are speaking, in one of its allowable outward forms, like the convocation of station wagons at the start of the year. Denise watched her mother pull the little cellophane ribbon on a bonus pack of 16 individually wrapped units of chewing gum. Her eyes narrowed as she turned back to the address books on the kitchen table before her. The 11-year-old face was an expert mask of restrained exasperation. She waited a long moment, then said evenly, "That stuff causes cancer in laboratory animals, in case you didn't know."
"You wanted me to chew sugarless gum, Denise. It was your idea."
"There was no warning on the pack then. They put a warning which I would have a hard time believing you didn't see."
She was transcribing names and phone numbers from an old book to a new one. There were no addresses. Her friends had phone numbers only, a race of people with a 7-bit analog consciousness.
"I'm happy to do it either way," Babette said. "It's totally up to you. Either I chew gum with sugar and artificial coloring, or I chew sugarless and colorless gum that's harmful to rats."
Steffi got off the phone.
"Don't chew at all," she said. "Did you ever think of that?"
Babette was breaking eggs into a wooden salad bowl. She gave me a look that wondered how the girl could talk on the phone and listen to us at the same time. I wanted to say because she finds us interesting. Babette said to the girls, "Look, either I chew gum or I smoke. If you want me to start smoking again, take away my chewing gum and my mentholyptus."
"Why do you have to do one or the other?" Steffi said. "Why not do neither one?"
"Why not do both?" Denise said, the face carefully emptying itself of expression.
"That's what you want, isn't it? We all get to do what we want, don't we? Except if we want to go to school tomorrow, we can't because they're fumigating the place or whatever."
The phone rang. Steffi grabbed it. "I'm not a criminal," Babette said. "All I want to do is chew a pathetic little tasteless chunk of gum now and then."
"Well, it's not that simple," Denise said. "It's not a crime either. I chew about 2 of those little chunks a day."
"Well, you can't anymore."
"Well, I can, Denise. I want to. Chewing happens to relax me. You're making a fuss over nothing."
Steffi managed to get our attention by the sheer pleading force of the look on her face. Her hand was over the mouthpiece of the phone. She did not speak, but only formed the words.
"The Stovers want to come over."
"Parents or children?" Babette said. My daughter shrugged. "We don't want them," Babette said.
"Keep them out," Denise said. "What do I say?"
"Say anything you want."
"Just keep them out of here.
They're boring.
Tell them to stay home."
Steffi retreated with the phone, appearing to shield it with her body, her eyes full of fear and excitement.
"A little gum can't possibly hurt," Babette said.
"I guess you're right. Never mind. Just a warning on the pack."
Steffi hung up.
"Just hazardous to your health," she said.
"Just rats," Denise said. "I guess you're right. Never mind."
"Maybe she thinks they died in their sleep."
"Just useless rodents, so what's the difference?"
"What's the difference? What's the fuss?" Steffi said.
"Plus, I'd like to believe she chews only 2 pieces a day the way she forgets things."
"What do I forget?" Babette said.
"It's all right," Denise said. "Never mind."
"What do I forget?"
"Go ahead and chew. Never mind the warning. I don't care." I scooped Wilder off a chair and gave him a noisy kiss on the ear, and he shrank away in delight. Then I put him on the counter and went upstairs to find Heinrich. He was in his room studying the deployment of plastic chessmen. "Still playing with the fellow in prison? How's it going?"
"Pretty good. I think I got him cornered."
"What do you know about this fellow? I've been meaning to ask."
"Like, who did he kill?"
"That's the big thing today, concern for the victim."
"You've been playing chess with the man for months. What do you know about him except that he's in jail for life, for murder?
Is he young, old, black, white? Do you communicate at all except for chess moves?"
"We send notes sometimes."
"Who did he kill?"
"He was under pressure."
"And what happened?"
"It kept building and building."
"So he went out and shot someone. Who did he shoot?"
"Some people in Iron City."
"How many?"
"Five."
"Five people?"
"Not counting the state trooper, which was later."
"Six people."
"Did he care for his weapons obsessively? Did he have an arsenal stashed in his shabby little room off a six-story concrete car park?"
"Some handguns and a bolt-action rifle with a scope."
"A telescopic sight?"
"Did he fire from a highway overpass? A rented room?"
"Did he walk into a bar, a washette, his former place of employment, and start firing indiscriminately? People scattering, taking cover under tables? People out on the street thinking they heard firecrackers? 'I was just waiting for the bus when I heard this little popping noise like firecrackers going off.'"
"He went up to a roof."
"A rooftop sniper."
"Did he write in his diary before he went up to the roof? Did he make tapes of his voice, go to the movies, read books about other mass murderers to refresh his memory?"
"Made tapes."
"Made tapes.
What did he do with them?"
"Sent them to people he loved, asking for forgiveness."
"I can't help myself, folks."
"Were the victims total strangers? Was it a grudge killing? Did he get fired from his job? Had he been hearing voices?"
"Total strangers."
"Had he been hearing voices?"
"On TV."
"Talking just to him? Singling him out?"
"Telling him to go down in history. He was 27, out of work, divorced, with his car up on blocks. Time was running out on him."
"Insistent, pressuring voices."
"How did he deal with the media? Give lots of interviews, write letters to the editor of the local paper, try to make a book deal?"
"There is no media in Iron City. He didn't think of that till it was too late.
He says if he had to do it all over again, he wouldn't do it as an ordinary murder. He would do it as an assassination.
He would select more carefully. Kill one famous person, get noticed, make it stick."
"He now knows he won't go down in history."
"Neither will I."
"But you've got Hitler."
"Yes, I have, haven't I?"
"What's Tommy Roy Foster got?"
"All right, he's told you all these things in the letters he sends. What do you say when you respond?"
"I'm losing my hair."
I looked at him. He wore a warm-up suit, a towel around his neck, sweatbands on both wrists.
"You know what your mother would say about this chess-by-mail relationship."
"I know what you would say. You're saying it."
"How is your mother? Hear from her lately?"
"She wants me to go out to the ashram this summer."
"Do you want to go?"
"Who knows what I want to do? Who knows what anyone wants to do? How can you be sure about something like that? Isn't it all a question of brain chemistry, signals going back and forth, electrical energy in the cortex?
How do you know whether something is really what you want to do or just some kind of nerve impulse in the brain? Some minor little activity takes place somewhere in this unimportant place in one of the brain hemispheres, and suddenly I want to go to Montana, or I don't want to go to Montana. How do I know I really want to go and it isn't just some neurons firing or something? Maybe it's just an accidental flash in the medulla, and suddenly there I am in Montana, and I find out I really didn't want to go there in the first place. I can't control what happens in my brain, so how can I be sure what I want to do 10 seconds from now, much less Montana next summer? It's all this activity in the brain, and you don't know what's you as a person and what's some neuron that just happens to fire or just happens to misfire. Isn't that why Tommy Roy killed those people? In the morning, I walked to the bank. I went to the automated teller machine to check my balance. I inserted my card, entered my secret code, tapped out my request. The figure on the screen roughly corresponded to my independent estimate, feebly arrived at after long searches through documents, tormented arithmetic. Waves of relief and gratitude flowed over me. The system had blessed my life. I felt its support and approval. The system hardware, the mainframe sitting in a locked room in some distant city. What a pleasing interaction. I sensed that something of deep personal value, but not money, not that at all, had been authenticated and confirmed. A deranged person was escorted from the bank by two armed guards. The system was invisible, which made it all the more impressive, all the more disquieting to deal with. But we were in accord, at least for now. The networks, the circuits, the streams, the harmonies. Chapter 11. I woke in the grip of a death sweat, defenseless against my own racking fears. A pause at the center of my being. I lacked the will and physical strength to get out of bed and move through the dark house, clutching walls and stair rails. To feel my way, re-inhabit my body, re-enter the world. Sweat trickled down my ribs. The digital reading on the clock radio was 3:51. Always odd numbers at times like this. What does it mean? Is death odd-numbered? Are there life-enhancing numbers, other numbers charged with menace? Babette murmured in her sleep, and I moved close, breathing her heat. Finally, I slept, to be awakened by the smell of burning toast. That would be Steffi. She burns toast often, at any hour, intentionally. She loves the smell. She is addicted. It's her treasured scent. It satisfies her in ways wood smoke cannot, or snuffed candles, or the odor of explosive powder drifting down the street from firecrackers set off on the 4th. She has evolved orders of preference: burnt rye, burnt white, so on. I put on my robe and went downstairs. I was always putting on a bathrobe and going somewhere to talk seriously to a child. Babette was with her in the kitchen. It startled me. I thought she was still in bed. "Want some toast?" Steffi said. "I'll be 51 next week." "That's not old, is it?" "I've felt the same for 25 years. "Bad. How old is my mother?" "She's still young. She was only 20 when we were married the first time." "Is she younger than Baba?" "About the same. Just so you don't think I'm one of those men who keeps finding younger women." I wasn't sure whether my replies were meant for Steffi or Babette. This happens in the kitchen, where the levels of data are numerous and deep, as Murray might say. "Is she still in the CIA?"
Steffi said.
"We're not supposed to talk about that. She's just a contract agent anyway."
"What's that?"
"That's what people do today for a second income."
"What exactly does she do?" Babette said.
"She gets a phone call from Brazil. That activates her."
"Then what?"
"She carries money in a suitcase the length and breadth of Latin America."
"That's all?
I could do that." "Sometimes they send her books to review."
"Have I met her?" Babette said.
"No."
"Do I know her name?"
"Dana Breedlove."
Steffi's lips formed the words as I spoke them.
"You're not planning to eat that, are you?" I said to her.
"I always eat my toast."
The phone rang, and I picked it up. A woman's voice delivered a high-performance hello. It said it was computer-generated, part of a marketing survey aimed at determining current levels of consumer desire. It said it would ask a series of questions, pausing after each one to give me a chance to reply. I gave the phone to Steffi. When it became clear that she was occupied with the synthesized voice, I spoke to Babette in low tones.
"She liked to plot."
"Who?"
"Dana. She liked to get me involved in things."
"What kind of things?"
"Factions. Playing certain friends against other friends. Household plots, faculty plots."
"Sounds like ordinary stuff."
"She spoke English to me, Spanish or Portuguese to the telephone."
Steffi twisted around, used her free hand to pull her sweater away from her body, enabling her to read the label.
"Virgin acrylic," she said into the phone.
Babette checked the label on her sweater. A soft rain began to fall.
"How does it feel being nearly 51? She said.
"No different from 50.
"Except one is even, one is odd," she pointed out.
That night, in Murray's off-white room, after a spectacular meal of Cornish hen in the shape of a frog, prepared on a two-burner hot plate, we moved from our metal folding chairs to the bunk bed for coffee.
"When I was a sports writer," Murray said, "I traveled constantly, lived in planes and hotels and stadium smoke. Never got to feel at home in my own apartment. Now I have a place."
"You've done wonders," Babette said, her gaze sweeping desperately across the room.
"It's small, it's dark, it's plain," he said in a self-satisfied way. "A container for thought."
I gestured toward the old four-story building on several acres across the street.
"Do you get any noise from the insane asylum?"
"You mean beatings and shrieks?
It's interesting that people still call it the insane asylum. It must be the striking architecture, the high steep roof, the tall chimneys, the columns, the little flourishes here and there that are either quaint or sinister. I can't make up my mind. It doesn't look like a rest home or a psychiatric facility. It looks like an insane asylum."
His trousers were going shiny at the knees.
"I'm sorry you didn't bring the kids. I want to get to know small kids. This is the society of kids. I tell my students they're already too old to figure importantly in the making of society. Minute by minute, they're beginning to diverge from each other. Even as we sit here, I tell them you are spinning out from the core, becoming less recognizable as a group, less targetable by advertisers and mass producers of culture. Kids are a true universal.
But you're well beyond that, already beginning to drift, to feel estranged from the products you consume.
Who are they designed for? What is your place in the marketing scheme? Once you're out of school,
It is only a matter of time before you experience the vast loneliness and dissatisfaction of consumers who have lost their group identity. Then I tap my pencil on the table to indicate time passing ominously. Because we were seated on the bed, Murray had to lean well forward, looking past the coffee cup poised in my hand, in order to address Babette. "How many children do you have, all told?" She appeared to pause. "There's Wilder, of course. There's Denise." Murray sipped his coffee, trying to look at her, sideways, with the cup at his lower lip. "There's Eugene, who's living with his daddy this year in Western Australia. Eugene is 8. His daddy does research in the outback. His daddy is also Wilder's daddy."
"The boy is growing up without television," I said, "which may make him worth talking to, Murray, as a sort of wild child, a savage plucked from the bush, intelligent and literate, but deprived of the deeper codes and messages that mark his species as unique."
"TV is a problem only if you've forgotten how to look and listen," Murray said. "My students and I discuss this all the time. They're beginning to feel they ought to turn against the medium, exactly as an earlier generation turned against their parents and their country. I tell them they have to learn to look as children again, root out content, find the codes and messages, to use your phrase, Jack."
"What do they say to that?"
"Television is just another name for junk mail. But I tell them I can't accept that. I tell them I've been sitting in this room for more than 2 months, watching TV into the early hours, listening carefully, taking notes. A great and humbling experience, let me tell you. Close to mystical."
"What's your conclusion?"
He crossed his legs primly and sat with the cup in his lap, smiling straight ahead. "Waves and radiation," he said. "I've come to understand that the medium is a primal force in the American home, sealed off, timeless, self-contained, self-referring. It's like a myth being born right there in our living room, like something we know in a dreamlike and preconscious way. I'm very enthused, Jack." He looked at me, still smiling in a half-sneaky way.
"You have to learn how to look. You have to open yourself to the data. TV offers incredible amounts of psychic data. It opens ancient memories of world birth. It welcomes us into the grid, the network of little buzzing dots that make up the picture pattern. There is light. There is sound. I ask my students, what more do you want? Look at the wealth of data concealed in the grid, in the bright packaging, the jingles, the slice-of-life commercials, the products hurtling out of darkness, the coded messages and endless repetitions, like chants, like mantras. Coke is it, Coke is it, Coke is it. The medium practically overflows with sacred formulas if we can remember how to respond innocently and get past our irritation, weariness, and disgust."
"But your students don't agree."
"Worse than junk mail. Television is the death throes of human consciousness, according to them. They're ashamed of their television past. They want to talk about movies."
He got up and refilled our cups.
"How do you know so much?" Babette said.
"I'm from New York."
"The more you talk, the sneakier you look, as if you're trying to put something over on us."
"The best talk is seductive."
"Have you ever been married?" she said.
"Once. Briefly. I was covering the Jets, the Mets, and the Nets. How odd a figure I must seem to you now, a solitary crank who maroons himself with a TV set and dozens of stacks of dust-jacketed comic books. Don't think I wouldn't appreciate a dramatic visit between 2 and 3 in the morning," he told her,
from an intelligent woman in spike heels and a slit skirt with high-impact accessories.
It was drizzling as we walked home, my arm around her waist. The streets were empty. Along Elm, all the